So this is question and answer Sunday, and I was just doing some kind of brush up on everything this morning, rereading the text, going over some notes so I'd be prepared for the questions that came in, and I realized, I told Barbara, I said, this is, I think, the first time that I've ever done a series that it lasted the whole summer. So this is the eighth week, and personally, I kind of like it. I kind of like just spending the whole summer in one area, kind of camping out there. But it makes sense, too, when preachers talk about preaching calendars. We look at the ebb and flow of attendance, and usually during the summer, attendance dips, which I'll be honest, I don't think that happened here at Hannah's Creek this year, so we're very blessed. But usually it dips in the summertime, and the people that stick around are those people that are grounded and they are ready to go deep. So that's kind of the thinking that I had going into this, but I've been amazed at how many of you have really been faithful to be here and hear everything. And I'm not going to give Shannon the opportunity to start with the first question because I already got my first question this morning. It was early this morning. Let me see what time it was. About between 7 and 7:30. I was actually doing some preparation, and Jake Kaufman texted me and said, "Hey, I got stuck at work, but I have a question." And I want to repeat the question and answer it because I think, you know, when I was younger, I enjoyed hearing other people's questions and getting those answers. So Jake's question revolved around the age of men and women. And he said, "Hey, I was just wondering, did women live to be as long as the men? Because when you read, you hear all of this men living to be 700 to 900 years old, but nothing ever about women." And then he went on to say, "So when God limited the years 220, was that already in place for women?" Which I think is an interesting question. It's a good question. But my response to Jake was, I think the reason that we don't get the age of the women is because, you know, it was a very patriarchal society and everything was traced through the men. So I think the women are living just, my opinion is the women are living just as long as the men. It's just not indicated because that's not how they wrote history down at that point in time. In the patriarchal society, the male part was, you know, kind of the recorded part. And I told Jake that, but I didn't answer this part of it. The 120 years, that comes from Genesis 6, the first few verses, when human beings began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years. Now, the way Jake interpreted this is like a lot of people do, is that the age will be limited to 120. There's an alternate translation to that. Some commentators say that what that really means is it would be 120 years before the flood from that point. So God sees the wickedness, and then from that point to the flood is 120 years. Because it takes a significant amount of time to build a boat the size of the ark if you're just one guy. Yeah, so could take 120 years. So that's the answer to Jake's question. I did send that in text, but if he's watching on Facebook, he got a double dose. All right, now I'm going to open the floor for the rest of you. And if you're watching on Facebook and you have a question, type it in the comments. The guys running the tech board back there, they should be able to see the chat pop up. And they can give me the question and I'll ask it and then answer it. There you go, Shannon. Well, to know for sure 100%, I don't think we can say one way or the other. The text indicates that it was a personification of God that was literally walking with Adam and Eve. The Hebrew grammar there indicates, you know, we get this one time in Genesis where God came down and walked with him, but the Hebrew indicates that it was a habitual thing, that this wasn't the first occurrence. It had happened
over and over and over. And we can kind of deduct that from the fact that they knew what the sound of God walking in the garden was. So they hear this and recognize it's God walking, and the result is they're ashamed. So it seems to be that it's a personification of God. I tend to take it that way. I don't think it's a spiritual analogy. I think it's a literal form of God walking with them. And at this point, remember, in the text, we've switched from designating God. We're no longer calling him just God in the text. It's the Lord God, Yahweh Elohim versus Elohim. And that raises the whole question of who is this Lord God, Yahweh? And some people would take that as maybe, you know, could the Lord God be the person of God the Son, Jesus, appearing? But I think it's hard to prove that textually. Good question. Now, the significance, I do want to kind of go off a tangent here a little bit. The significance of that is, I think we have a tendency to look at that and say that that aspect was lost because of the fall. But if we read later in the text, we'll still find that there were individuals that walked with God. Like that was what was said of Noah. That was what was said of Enosh. They walked with God. And so this capacity to walk with God or go with God, it remains a possibility even in a fallen world. And I think that's kind of where it hits, you know, for us. We have the capacity to walk with God, to go with God. And the idea is, when we're walking with God, we are in tune with his standards. The walking with God was lost with Adam and Eve when they said, no, we're not going to listen to your standards. We're going to kind of set our own standard as to what's good. Next question. David. Okay, so your question is a question that a lot of people have, so I'm going to restate it. With God's omniscience, he knows everything. Why send the serpent? I'm going to say, why allow the serpent? Because I don't think God just directly sent the serpent to tempt, but I think he allowed it. And why did he allow the serpent, knowing the outcome? And to answer the question, I think when we look at that aspect, we sometimes look at the story of the fall and we see like plan A was perfection, and then all of a sudden that was lost, so now God goes to plan B and this is what I have to do to remedy that. But I don't think that's the case at all. I think there was never a plan B. Plan A was always exactly what happened, because when we look at John's words in Revelation, you know, I've come back to this several times in the series. In Revelation, he sees the image of Jesus, and he says, "Behold the Lamb of God who was slain from the foundation of the world." And so this correlates back to Genesis 1, where we say Genesis 1 is the king on the throne, God the king, making a decree, you know, let there be light, and then in the earthly realm it unfolds. And I think the same thing can be said about the death and resurrection of Jesus. At the same time that God was making these decrees in Genesis 1 about creation, he has decreed that Jesus would die for the sin of mankind. So if you can kind of wrap your mind around God and time, it's difficult, and a lot of people go a lot of different directions, but I have a tendency to align with C.S. Lewis. When C.S. Lewis talks about God and time, he talks about the eternal now. Like there is no past or future with God. It's always now. And when you think of God that way, at the instant that he thought of creation, it's the same instant that the sin of humanity was dealt with. And so there's no time lapse in God's mind of, okay, I've started creation now. Oh, now they've sinned. Okay, now I have to think of something else. It was, he created, he knew they would fall, but he already had a plan. That was part of the plan. And I think that's why in the garden, he says, he gives them the rule, right? Don't eat of this tree. But then he says, when you eat from it, not if, like when you eat from it, you will die. So yes, he knew. Did he send the serpent to cause that? No, I don't think so. I think he allowed it because the allowance, you know, sets this plan of his into motion. I don't know if that's a sufficient answer or not. But it relates to the question of why does a good God allow bad things? And I think that's something that we all have to wrestle with individually. For me, why does a good God allow bad things? Well, it only makes sense in my mind that a good God would allow bad things because those bad things produce good results. They produce glory for him. They're not meant to, the allowance is not meant to, you know, condemn us for eternity. The results are that it's preparing us for eternity. Did you have another question, Eugene? Okay.
The second thing was, I just never thought it was, you know, almost like a dentist snake makes a call on its belly, and it talks about one strike at the tip, I'm assuming it was kill a snake, yet the snake was still able to bite the heel.
So the curse is interesting. He curses the snake, and that's in Genesis 3, verse 15. Part of the curse is he says, I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head and you will strike his heel. I don't know if I should say most, but a lot of commentators, and I think this is a messianic prophecy myself. I think this is an image of, right here in the very beginning, chapter 3, of Jesus, the offspring of Eve, right? If you trace that lineage, Jesus goes back to Seth. It's the image of Christ on the cross, where the serpent strikes his heel. It's a deadly blow, but at the same time, the death of Jesus squashes, conquers the evil of the serpent in the garden. That's a good question, too. Now, some commentators would say that's not a messianic prophecy, but I have a tendency to think it is. Because it is a singular, it's not, when it in Hebrew, when it says your offspring, it's not a plural. It's a singular, it's your seed, one. It's pointing to the one. And remember, as the text unfolds into chapter 4, we get Cain and Eve is like, oh, here's the one. And then, oh, wait, no, it's not the one. Okay. So remember, the story, it's pushing forward to who's the one? That's the question. Who's this one that's going to crush the head of the serpent? And we kind of get our hopes up, and then they fall. We get our hopes up, and then they fall. But it's a story that tells who's coming, who is it? And it should kind of spark people's mind, and it certainly would the ancient readers, to be looking for this person. We're still waiting for this person that's going to do this. And we don't get the answer until the New Testament. Good question. Couple questions. All right. Next question. I thought this one would be like everybody would have questions. Because it was a deep one. Anything else? Rudy.
Sin,
Okay, so your question is, after the fall in the garden, in chapter 3, verse 21, God makes clothes of skin and covers Adam and Eve. And your question is, could this be the first animal sacrifice? Some commentators would say yes, this is the first form of animal sacrifice. It's feasible. I think it's logical to say that. I don't think you have to say that this is the first form of animal sacrifice, but it does make sense. This is certainly the first time that we have seen death in the text, God killing, obviously, animals and covering, using those skins to cover humanity. I think it's a good argument that it does kind of set up the basis for animal sacrifice within the Israelite religion, because what it does is it covers their shame. You know, they see each other for the first time with these new eyes that aren't pure anymore, and they're kind of ashamed of what they see. They recognize they're different, and so God has to do something about it. Yeah, same question. Could you repeat that? In terms of sacrifice, it's not offered to God. Okay, so your observation is, where this differs from animal sacrifices, when animal sacrifices are instituted, those are offered to God. In this case, these aren't sacrifices that are offered for God. You're correct. It's not. And that's why I think it does not have to, we don't have to look at this and say, this is the institution of animal sacrifice. What we have to see is, the point is, the insufficiency of man to cover their own shame and the sufficiency of God. There's a difference there. Because before, they take fig leaves and sew them together. It's an attempt on their part to say, wow, we messed up, we got to fix it. And the image is, well, you tried, but it's not sufficient. It's only sufficient when God steps in and covers the shame that's brought on by sin. And so I don't think we need to get caught up in the fine details. The big picture is, man tried to cover it, it didn't work. God steps in and fixes the problem. And when we talked about this, this is where we went with the modern implications. For us, it's the same way. When we fall short of God's standard, there's some shame that comes along with that. You know, we feel the shame of, we messed up. And naturally, our instinct is, we want to try to fix it. You know, we want to try to do better next time. We want to try to do more good. But the reality is, there's nothing that we can do to cover that shame or fix that shame that is accrued by sin. God has to step in. And the relation is, it points back to, okay, who's this one that's going to crush the head? It's Jesus. He steps in. He covers our shame, our sin, because we can't do it ourselves. I think that's really what the text is about. Good question. Thanks. All right, next question. Anything back there on Facebook land, David? Anybody?
So the biggest question I get is about people asking, when it says God created Adam and Eve, and then Adam and Eve had three sons, like, how did you get all these people that have in the world? And my question is, how likely is it that Adam and Eve and the story of the garden happened in the heavenly God created the earth as well, and then when the fall happened, Adam and Eve and the enemy fell to the earth, and then that's when they had Cain, Abel, and Seth, and then they went out and populated the earth.
Okay, so your question was, how do we get so many people from just Adam and Eve on earth? And then you kind of said, is it possible that there are already humans on earth, and then Adam and Eve were in the heavenly realm, and when they sinned, they fell. I did some research on that. There is a theory that says, you know, Eden, the Garden of Eden, is in the in a heavenly realm, and then Adam and Eve do fall. There is a theory that says that. I think it's possible that that's the case, but I have a tendency to read it more literal. I have a tendency to think that the garden was this place where heaven and earth met. It wasn't necessarily in a different realm. So when I read the story, I see it as the garden's the sanctuary, the, you know, that becomes perpetuated in the tabernacle and the temple. This is where God and humanity meet. And so that doesn't really address the problem of how do you have all these people from just two. Some people speculate that what we see is when we read these genealogies in chapter 5 and chapter 10, that the genealogies aren't complete. And it's quite possible that, you know, Adam and Eve have more children than Cain, Abel, and Seth. The genealogies are written this way for a reason. They kind of, you know, they're in there. I'm not saying that they're not accurate. They're accurate, but they're not always, not everybody's listed. The people that are listed for a reason. So when we think in terms of just two people, it's possible Adam and Eve had more kids, and the propagation of humanity happened rather quickly. I wish I could remember where I saw this, but I did watch a video on how did we get to the number of people that we see in Genesis 6 from Adam and Eve. And when you look at population growth, it is very feasible that from just two, we could get millions in the time span that's covered in Genesis. Remember, Genesis, the book, covers 2,500 years of history. And if we think about population in our day and age, if we just look at the population of the United States, for instance, from 1776 till now, the population growth is, you know, exponential. So once you start having so many, you know, just from two people, and it's not just adding, it's now multiplication growth, the issue of the all the people kind of slides into the background in my mind. There's some other theories out there that I don't know that are worth mentioning in this setting, but I can talk to you about that. Any other questions? Yeah, and what translation are you reading there, can I ask? ESV. Can you read that again from the ESV?
It says, and this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing that they propose to do now will be impossible for them.
Okay. And so your question, you're just saying that that verse has piqued your interest.
Yeah, really what it means.
Okay, so what does Genesis 11:6, this is the NIV, the Lord said, if as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. And in the context of where this is at, so you're just asking for a little bit deeper explanation, okay. In the context of where this at, this is in the story of Babel, the Tower of Babel. And all the people, rather than, you know, really scattering out and filling the creation, they're congregating together. And I think it's a story of empire, building an empire. And I think what's happening is with verse 6, the emphasis is when humanity comes together, they can accomplish a lot. When there's unity, they can do a lot of things. The problem in this case is that they are unified around making a name for themselves, and that's the key. The point is, like, God wants people to know his name. That was the purpose of setting humans into creation. The language used is, and some people probably get a little squirrely over this, but the language used is the same language used for temple idols. That's what humans are called in creation. We are the temple idols. That's what it means to be made in his image. When people look at us, we should represent him. In 11, what you get is we want to make a name for ourselves. Who cares if they know who the creator is through us? And when I did talk about this, you know, the tower, there's some language in there that indicates they're really building an idol. It's the word is head, the top of the tower is with a head that reaches to the sky. And really, I think what Moses is doing here is Daniel picks up on this imagery. Daniel, or Moses, is talking about this. These people are building an idol. They're making a name for themselves. And then Daniel uses the same language in the same place, the plain of Shinar, to talk about the king of Babylon, what's he doing? He's building an idol with a head that's him. And so I think there's a play there. The problem is, what's the similarities? Well, Babel and Babylon, they're the same place. They've always been crazed with creating an empire, forcing people to be like them, become who they are, rather than who God wants them to be. Does that work for deeper explanation? Collectively, people can do a lot. And what I said in this sermon specifically, what we unify, this is where the modern implication is, what we unify around matters. And I think that's the point. What they were unifying around was not God-oriented. And so the opposite is when the church unifies around the right things, it can be a powerful force in the world. Good. Thanks for bringing that up. Next question. Jeff, you had one, right?
Yeah. Getting back to the genealogies of everyone and the line.
Mm-hmm.
Enoch walked with God,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't go and die as all the others had.
Yeah. So your question is, we have the man who walked with God and it says he was taken up, that he didn't die. I avoided that in the sermon series because I have no idea. I don't. I wish I could give you a good answer to that.
But Jesus died and was resurrected.
Right. Jesus
did not have to go through death because was his relationship so close with God, and he only lived to be 365 days, which is a lot less than everyone else at that point.
365 years, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Years.
So, yeah, that's a good question. You know, you have, that's in the first genealogy in chapter 5, right?
Yeah.
Enoch, he lived 65 years. Oh, that's when he became the father of Methuselah. Yeah, and let's see. Altogether, Enoch lived a total of 365 years. Enoch walked faithfully with God. Then he was no more because God took him away. I don't know if you'll give me just a second here. I don't know if I have the, I don't have internet. This is how my crazy mind works. I'll give you a snapshot into it real quick. There's this neat little tool called Bible Hub or Blue Letter Bible where you can do some cross-reference of the English to the original language. And I probably should have done that before this, but yeah, I don't have any internet at all. Let's see, what is that? Genesis 5, 24. We'll see what
the original language says in that. But again, this is kind of correlated to that whole idea of walking with God. You know, you see, the same thing was said of Noah. And Noah was spared. And I mean, he died, obviously, but Enoch, it doesn't seem that he died. Took him. God took him. Lakah. Well, that's interesting. The word is, the Hebrew word is lakah, and we translate it as to take, but the most, the way it's translated most is to accept. God accepted him. I don't know, Jeff. I wish I could answer your question, but maybe I think
the, he was just one of three.
Yeah. Elijah. Yeah. So between him and Elijah, they were taken up. The thing for me, the difference, Elijah, we, you know, get this whole storyline of what Elijah's done and responsible for. Enoch, we don't get that. We just get he walked faithfully. In the midst of all this, I think in the context, you know, in the midst of this evil that's going on, we see the important piece of that. Even in the midst of evil, there are still individuals that are walking with God. So whether he died or was taken up, he's in the same boat as Noah. There's a little pun there. He's in the same boat. Yeah.
In reference to that, I don't know if we talked about it or if I read it, but it seems to me that they think that these two are the prophets that's going to be in preaching the gospel, and that's when they're going to suffer death, when they kill him.
Okay. So this, the comment or question over here was, when you look at Revelation, there's two prophets that are going to come back and preach the gospel, proclaim the gospel. There are some commentators that think that Enoch and Elisha would be those two because they have not experienced death. They'll come back, preach the gospel, be martyred at that point where they would experience death. That is one theory. That is one way of translating that. And it could be. I'm going to steer clear away from that one because we're in Genesis, not Revelation. But I think it's feasible. I think that is feasible. For those two individuals have seemingly not experienced death, that is a feasible translation to say that maybe they are the two that would, depending on how you interpret Revelation. You know, sometime we'll have to do a series through Revelation, but not right after this. Any other questions? Gary. Okay. Is that the question? Okay. So you're, I don't even want to call that a question. Your statement was, Adam created in the image of God, and you said not the intellect, not the knowledge, but in the physical image. I would disagree. I don't think it is a physical image. I don't think it's indicative of a physical image of God. I do think it's more along the lines of, and you and I talked about this a little bit, and this is going to
really be deep for some people. There are two aspects of God's holiness. Boy, you're really going to be in seminary today. Thanks. We talk about God's ethical holiness and his ontological holiness. God's ontological holiness, it's really what sets him apart, what makes him God. And there is nothing in creation that can attain his ontological holiness. It's just his otherness is a kind of a simple way to put it. But his ethical holiness, the ability to think, reason, know right from wrong, and make appropriate decisions based on his standard. That's the ethical holiness. And this is what I think that term is. I think when it says that we were made in the image of God, it means that we can work toward his ethical holiness. Not that we become God or close to God, but the fact that we have the ability to rationalize, think, reason, make decisions, and to be morally pure. I think that's what that means. And so, while we are created beings, we will never be God or be like God in terms of, you know, on the same platform. He created us to represent him and how he acts on behalf of his creation. That's the point. That's where we, as the image of God, we represent his character to the rest of creation. Okay. I believe Adam had full free will to make a good decision or a bad decision. It relates to, the temptation is, you will be like God. You'll know good from evil. And when we read that, I think sometimes we assume, they didn't know. But it never says that. See, the serpent tempted them with something that they already had. They were like God. God said himself, let us make mankind in our likeness, in our image. Humanity was like God. They knew the difference between good and evil. They had the capacity, and the serpent twisted it and manipulated it to make them feel insufficient. To make them feel like they needed something when in reality they already had it. And in their attempt to attain it, to be their own God, they lost it. And I think that's, as the story unfolds, that's what we see a lot of times. The thing that they want most, they lose. At Babel, we'll wrap it back around to that. The thing that they wanted most was to be all together and to make a name for themselves. And how does it end? Scattered. And most of them unnamed, unknown. They can't even understand each other anymore. And so the thing that people want to attain most, a lot of times they already have it. They're just not satisfied to live under that auspice of God being the dominant one. Like, if we don't have it, he's holding out, so we got to usurp his power, his throne, and take it ourselves. And then we lose it all. Is that sufficient enough for you? Okay. You got another one?
God's decisions throughout the scriptures about
when he interacts with us, we got Saul to Paul. God has decided right then to interact with mankind. Saul. Is that the story for us?
So you're, let me try to. So you're talking about God's choice, your God's.
I'm confused about why we're blessed with free will to make all these mistakes over and over and over through the scriptures. Saul's right along, if I remember correctly, he's not going to be able to find it because God has decided no free will here.
Okay, so. You're wrestling with free will, God's timing, interacting with humanity, and you've taken that to Saul, who becomes Paul, and you made the statement that God decides to take free will out of the equation at that point, and he has no choice. Do you think that he really didn't have a choice? I mean, yeah, I think Saul still had a choice. I mean, God made it pretty hard on him, right? God made it pretty hard. It would be hard for me to stand there, be blinded, and hear God's voice and deny that, but I think there was still the capacity to do so. I don't think we read that because he didn't choose that route. He chose to, you know, follow. It's hard to, I understand, you know, when we read through this, especially in the Genesis 1 through 11, and to think about the providence of God and free will versus no free will, and to think about how God is in control of all things, but at the same time, we have the ability to make choices that impact not only ourselves, but the rest of creation. It's so hard to describe the sovereignty of God in the midst of human decision and choice, but the best scenario I can think of is to kind of put it pretty, it's probably a poor illustration, it's pretty simple, but you know, we too have the capacity of foreknowledge. Humans have the ability to know something before it happens. If you would think of yourself, you know, around here we don't have any of these. We don't have high-rise buildings here. But if you put yourself in Chicago or New York, and you're in a high-rise, and you got a big a vantage point above everything else. Let's say you're on the 26th floor of a high-rise building, and you're in the corner of the building, and you see the intersection of roads, right? And from that perspective, you're looking down and you can see on both sides of the building, and you see two cars coming to the intersection at the same time. You at that moment have a knowledge of what's about to happen. You know beforehand that the cars are going to collide. You have foreknowledge. Now, because you knew that, did you cause those cars to collide? No, you knew it, but you didn't cause it. Those drivers making their own decisions caused it, but you knew it was going to happen. I think when I think of God's foreknowledge, I don't think because he knows all things, it doesn't mean that he has to be the direct cause of all things. I think that he allows these things, certainly, but directly causing, I think the direct cause is he chose to give us the ability to make decisions. And when he chose to give us the ability to make decisions, he also chose to limit himself as to how he would intervene or when he would intervene. Doesn't mean that he's limited because he did it himself. He said, this is how it's going to go. And just because he knows the decisions that we make, just because he knew the decision that Adam made and Eve made, doesn't mean that he caused the decision. He knew it, and it's still unfolding, and he's still in control, all working toward one specific purpose, one specific person that remedies the whole solution. That's a tough question. Thanks for asking. Any others? We're about out of time. So your question is there any similarities between pagan myths and this and the stories after Genesis 11, like Abraham, Isaac, and all that? Are they polemic? That's the question, right? I did make it a point throughout this whole series to say I think a lot of what we see here in the first 11 chapters is polemic, which means it attacks paganism. It attacks their creation stories. Is there some similarities after we get out of Genesis 11? I'm not sure. And the reason I say that is because when we get to Genesis 12, we shift in purpose and intent. At this point, now we're getting to the question of who's that person. Now we see a lineage that's being presented that leads somewhere. But you're right, there are some serious similarities between the Abraham offering Isaac, because in Mesopotamian beliefs there was the god Molech, and they sacrificed children to Molech. The only argument I could make against this being a similarity would be the age of Isaac. For Molech, they offered young kids. Isaac was actually not very young when Abraham went through the ritual of sacrifice. I think most people would put him around in his 20s, which is interesting considering that Abraham would have been an old man, and how did he get him strapped down? Or, you know, Isaac was willing to lay there, obviously. I think that's a foreshadowing. That event is a foreshadowing of the offering of a son and the willingness of a father to offer a son. And in this event, though, God, what does God do? He provides another sacrifice. And the correlation is God offers God the Son, Jesus, and it's a provided sacrifice for all of us who are asked to sacrifice. Good question. You've all read ahead. You're asking questions outside of chapters 1 through 11. Okay, I got time for one more. This is your last chance. We'll close the first 11 chapters of Genesis. Any on Facebook, David? Did you see anything pop up back there on comments? All right. One last time. Going once. Any final questions? Going twice. All right. That's it for Genesis 1 through 11. I hope you enjoyed the series. If you haven't been with us very often, we always do a question and answer at the end of a sermon series. It just so happens that this one was 8 weeks long, so there was a lot to cover.